broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Take heart that in Detroit, every 3 seconds, a car is born. C.K. Stead. It takes 6,720 man-hours to make a baby, give or take. The catch is it must be the same man and that man, a woman. We cannot specialize. We cannot automate. We cannot use assembly lines or lean production techniques to accelerate the timeline. We cannot do anything. She must do it all. Her body assembles the baby, step by step, though her brain does not know how. She builds a heart in only 18 days. She constructs the intestinal tract, starting with the anus, of course. She engineers a custom machine designed at random within certain parameters and built in the dark. At 6,720 hours, the deadline looms, and she always delivers. Holly Painter in the Delmarva Review, Volume 11. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. The 11th volume of the Delmarva Review was published this month, and my guests are the executive editor of the review, Wilson Wyatt, and the review's poetry editor, Ann Colwell. Wilson Wyatt was one of the founders of the review. He was a journalist and the head of communications at three corporations. More recently, Wilson served on the board of the Writers Center in Bethesda, Maryland. Ann Colwell is an English professor at the University of Delaware. She has published 2 books of poetry, won an award for her novel, Holy Day. Anne is a master writer, and along with Wilson, has appeared on Delmarva Today Writers Edition a number of times. In the spirit of full disclosure, I'll also let you know that I'm the fiction editor of the review. Wilson and Anne, welcome to Delmarva Today Writers Edition.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hal.
Our program is in 2 parts today. First is a discussion of the new Delmarva Review with Ann and Wilson, and the second is a dramatic reading of one of the review's fiction pieces, Prairie Fever by Emily Ray Roberts. It's read by Madeline Slater. As an added feature today, the review recently had a reading at the Writers' Center in Bethesda, Maryland, and we're fortunate to be able to share one of the poems from that reading and a piece of flash fiction from the reading as well. Wilson, let me begin with you. This is volume 11 of the review. I am assuming that speaks of 11 years of issues that have been produced. This volume 11 is a beautiful edition, and it's quite weighty and feels substantial, frankly. How is this volume different from the volumes in the past that you've produced?
To begin with, it's 300 pages long. That's a pretty good indication. Most literary journals are under 200 pages, so it's quite weighty, as you say. We published 45 writers selected from thousands of submissions from around the United States and around the world, actually. Half of those, I might mention, are from the Delmarva and Chesapeake region. The cover, the beautiful cover, which helps, as you say, make it a beautiful edition, is of the iconic leaning of Sharp's Island Light, the lighthouse on the Chesapeake Bay, by photographer Jay Fleming of Annapolis. Jay is actually originally from Delaware, and he has a studio in Annapolis. He contributed that cover piece, which we're appreciative of. When we started the review 11 years ago, as you mentioned, I'll mention that we have published the 300th writer in this edition, which is quite an accomplishment for a nonprofit literary journal in 11 years. The purpose of the journal is to create a valued publication for writers. We exist for writers and for readers, but that's our purpose, is to help writers achieve a place, a niche for their writing in the very best publication that they can aspire to. In that capacity, we publish poetry, short fiction, and creative nonfiction. So it's a real pleasure. In this edition, we're particularly happy with this edition because it is our largest by far, and we hope to have many more.
Well, let me ask you, Wilson, you're publishing, as you said, poetry, fiction, and nonfiction offerings. But I saw an interesting new genre that got my attention, micro nonfiction. Wilson, what is I've read a lot of Delmarva reviews, but I don't think I have seen micro nonfiction in the past. What is micro nonfiction?
You haven't seen it in the past. This is our first. We included four micro nonfiction pieces, and from a writer to in Hawaii, actually. And the purpose of micro nonfiction is, in a very condensed space, to create a story that creates a feeling for the reader. And it's, as it says, it's highly condensed. It's you have a full story, you have a voice and a plot, and it all takes place within a few hundred words.
In terms of the poetry in this issue, I thought it was really outstanding, and not that the poetry in all the other issues isn't really good, but I thought that I noticed a little different quality or different aspect to the poetry in this issue. So can you tell us if you felt in a similar way, and why this poetry has appears at least to be so of such high quality? And then the other question I'd like to ask you is, out of the thousands of poems that you receive as submissions, how do you choose among them for the ones that you would like to publish?
Well, let me answer the first question first. That I think that one of the things that makes this issue special is that we have a broader range of voices than we have ever had in any other issue. We always have very high quality poetry, but I think that one of the things that has happened in this issue is that the more we've published really high quality poets, the more high quality poems we're getting. And so one of the things that is that makes this issue special is that we have such a broad range of voices, and those voices are interacting with each other across the issue in a really beautiful way. I think that that Wilson and the other editors who helped put it together as a final piece. And you know, it's always hard to make the decisions about what goes where in the issue. But I have started reading it front to back. And of course, that's not my experience of the poems as they come in. But so it's really interesting to see how the poems speak to each other across the issue, and how those voices are almost singing together. So I think that that's one of the things that makes the poetry in this issue special, is just that broad range of voices and the way those voices speak to each other. As for how we choose from the thousands of poems that we get, I think Wilson just told me that we had over 3,000 submissions last year, and that it's very difficult because we get such great poems, and we turn good poems and good poets away all the time. And, you know, so if you've gotten rejected, please don't feel like that means you should never send again, because it's not, a rejection is often not that the work isn't good. It's just maybe that we've taken something that's very close to it already, or that, that I'm tired on the day when I read it, so I don't hear it the way I should. But one of the things that I'm listening for is a real human voice speaking to me. And so the first thing I'm listening for is that voice. And then I'm listening for a voice that's searching for something. I don't think that I'm as attracted to voices that already have their mind made up in poetry. I think that the best kind of poems are taking me with them as they ask questions about the world and about our lives and about grief and hope and love. And, you know, that I have a person in front of me who has something that they really desperately need to figure out. And if the poem is moving through that progression, I'm much more attracted to that voice and to that poet than somebody who's got something, you know, a lesson for me, something they already have all figured out and they want to tell me. I'm looking for surprising language. That's always important. So that the language somehow catches my ear, that it's musical, that it has beautiful images or terrible images, depending on what the poem is. So those are the things I'm looking for, but especially a voice, and maybe that thought as we think our way through or feel our way through something.
Well, we're going to hear a poem in a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you about a particular poem.
Okay.
In this issue, and that poem is called Entropy, and I wondered if you wouldn't mind reading that poem for us, and then let's talk about it a little bit.
This is a poem by Adam Tamashaski, and it's called Entropy. I don't know that much about entropy, except that I don't call my brother much anymore. Holidays and birthdays, ours and our kids, but the bonds weaken over time. It's enough now to leave a voicemail. Our lives, like leaves, have branched apart, though a thin root keeps us briefly in touch. But I see these October leaves around my feet now, and I can't tell which ones grew up together. I've taught my daughter so many lessons, how to hold my hand across the street, how to hold on to me in the deep end. But now I wish I'd offered better lessons. What their sister's hands in theirs can feel like. How not to let go during the fall.
What's going on in that poem, Anne?
I love that poem. And actually, there are several really good poems by Adam Tomaszewski in the volume. But one of the things that I love about this poem is that it takes basically a you know scientific physical concept, the poem deepens and deepens and deepens, and I feel like what happens is that in those original images, like I don't call my brother much anymore, holidays and birthdays, and in that first stanza, and you can't tell us the first stanza ends with the October leaves around my feet. And then the second stanza is, I've taught my daughter so many lessons. So in the first stanza, he's really talking about his own life with his brother and the feeling of failing that relationship and wishing he hadn't failed that relationship, especially as the October leaves then, of course, become that natural and sort of universal symbol that many cultures share for death and loss and coming death and loss as we age. And so then the second stanza looks forward and says, I have two daughters. Have I taught them the same bad lesson I had about the importance of siblings and connection and love and familial love that goes on after your parents are dead and after you've grown up together and that has to go on, you know, for that deep-rooted connection to last. And I think that there's something that just gets me about those last two lines of the poem, what their sister's hands in theirs can feel like, how not to let go during the fall. But again, you notice that like this poem doesn't say, I have not taught them or I have taught them or I should teach them. It just says, did I do this? Are they going to be okay? And I think that that's one of the things that attracts me about the poem. It doesn't tell me what I should be doing or what he should have done, but it has that human feeling of, oh, I hope I've done the right thing. You know, I hope theirs is going to be better than mine is. And so that's one of the things I just love about that poem.
I agree with that. It has to do with the progression of time, too, as an age. And did I do this right? And I hope I did. It's a beautiful piece.
It's interesting that I have a little bit different emphasis came to me from the poem. Entropy is basically the definition of time in the scientific sense. That is that time is an arrow that goes forward, and in the poem, what I saw a little bit, what you saw, Wilson, was the progression of time. Not so much about how the author felt about what was happening, and I know you picked that up, Anne, and Wilson, you too. I got the sense, though, that the poem was a magnificent definition of the movement of time and how time, as in entropy, time separates. And the relationships gradually fade, and then the fall also speaks of the movement of time, that it is the fall of life now, and what we remember of the past is the feel, that he wants them to remember the feel of the hands. I mean, maybe I'm not interpreting right, Anne. You can correct me. You're the professor here.
Well, I absolutely think you're exactly right about the time part, but I do feel like he is offering another possibility than the possibility that happened with him and his brother. And that at the end of the poem, it's not just you'll remember the feeling of her hands when you guys are way far apart and you call you call hardly ever and you can leave a voicemail, but that the better lesson, like he says, I wish I'd offered better lessons. And I think that when he says, if you remember enough what your sister's hands can feel like, right, what their sister's hands in theirs can feel like, then you don't let go. As you get older, you how not to let go during the fall. So, and then the fall, of course, has that, you know, you're falling, so it's really hard not to let go. And like you said, that is, it's what time does, right? Time pulls us apart, pulls us in all different directions. But is there a way that what happens with his daughters is going to be different than what happened with him and his brother? And I think there's something beautiful about at least the hope for that in the future.
Well, that's the genius of the poem,
yeah,
isn't it? And I believe it is, does express the genius of entropy and shows us the genius of the poem as well. Wilson, the Writers' Center had a reading recently. Tell us a little bit about the reading of this Delmarva Review at the Writers' Center in Bethesda, Maryland.
Well, we just had an opening of the review to celebrate the review at the Writers' Center, which was very kind of them to do. And we had 9 writers, including poets, nonfiction, and fiction writers, each reading from their work. And the it was a wonderful occasion. It was a packed house in Bethesda and lots of people, and we hope to do it. We hope to do some more over here on the Eastern Shore, as a matter of fact.
Well, we were fortunate to be able to record the readings and wanted to share with our audience a couple of those. The first one is titled Responsibility by Holly Karapetkova, and it is and part of a progression of poems. So maybe you could give us a little introduction of that series of poems, and then we'll hear Holly Karapetkova read her poem.
Well, it's a series of poems that deals with slavery, but I think it deals with slavery and the events of slavery in a really different kind of way, in that it makes it gives voice to the individuals who have been enslaved, and their voices are, one of the things that I love about this series of poems is that their voices are not all what we would expect, right? There's a whole range of emotions, so that they become really human voices that we hear in each of these different poems, and it's a beautiful, beautiful series.
The other interesting aspect of these poems is that she picked a brief piece of reading from that era that people wrote in the early 1800s, 1830s, and on, and used each of those. And our listeners will hear that one of the introductions that she picked. And let's listen to Holly read her poem, Responsibility, and then respond to that for us, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And the last one I'm going to read from this series is called Responsibility. And one of the really interesting things about women in the plantation South is that they were expected to be good caretakers of their slaves. Their slaves were like their children, and they were supposed to model good behavior and love and teach them. And they were really, they had this weird position. They were sort of supposed to smooth over this very ugly and horrific system, and they were supposed to make it look nice and functioning. And there are all these kind of self-help books written for women teaching them how to do this. And there's one called Virginia Housewife or Methodical Cook, from 1828 by Mary Randolph. It's a good read if you're interested. It's free online. And the epigraph, the quote that I've taken from this book reads, "When the kitchen breakfast is over and the cook has put all things in their proper places, the mistress should go in to give her orders. The mistress must tax her own memory with all this. We have no right to expect slaves or hired servants to be more attentive to our interest than we ourselves are." And the poem is called Responsibility. And it reads across and then down in two columns. So I'll read it across and then I'll read down. With one hand, I serve tea cakes on the blue India china. With the other, I wipe mosquitoes sweating from my neck. With one voice, I order French terrines from Calder's and Company. With another, I order the cook not to burn the gravy. The hush of what is beneath the damask tablecloth at night grows knives. With one mouth, I smile at the good doctor. With the other, I grit my teeth, watching dark eyes, always watching me. They know what moves in shadows, refuse to polish the silver for love of tarnish. They know the other names for everything, names they flash like knives when no one is around looking. With one hand, the blue, with the other, sweating, with one voice, terrines from Calder's, with another, not to burn. The hush of damask at night. With one mouth, the good doctor, with my teeth, always. They know what moves, refuse to polish for love of the other names they flash when no one is around. I serve tea cakes on India china. I wipe mosquitoes from my neck. I order French and Company. I order the cook, the gravy. What is beneath the tablecloth grows knives. I smile at the other. I grit, watching dark eyes, watching me. In shadows, the silver tarnish. They know for everything names like knives looking.
Tell us about this poem, Anne.
First of all, I just want to say something about the incredible brilliance of the two ways of reading the poem, so that you can read it one way where it becomes much more narrative, and then you can read it another way where it becomes much more imagistic. And in both ways, you still get that same strong voice and the same feel, especially images like, you know, what is beneath the tablecloth grows knives. And there's something so compelling about each one of these images. And in it's really two poems in one poem, which is so interesting because there's something that's happening in the poem itself that's two in one, where you have the external woman who has to, you know, do what she has to do and to become this persona. But then all of the wrenching emotional life that goes on underneath this very smooth looking surface, serving on the blue damask and at the same time wiping mosquitoes from your sweaty neck. It's just, boy, it's a brilliant, brilliant poem. And actually, she just reads it so well there, too. I'm glad that she read it both ways.
Well, we said earlier that the poetry in this issue was outstanding.
That's great.
And both entropy and responsibility meet that incredibly high quality of poetry. Also, in this edition is our fiction, and the fiction is outstanding as well. We're going to hear a reading of one of the fiction pieces called Prairie Fever, and that's an amazing work by actually an undergraduate It's extremely good. I'd like to mention, and Wilson, you can then join me here if you would on the fiction. I'd like to mention a few that I thought were quite good, and one is American Dream. And American Dream is kind of a simple story, but incredibly meaningful and moving as well. A family in single A baseball venue houses players that have come up, and a lot of them from Central America, and come into the major leagues in single A ball, and they offer them a room. And this man has a daughter, and the story speaks of the relationship between the daughter and the Central American baseball player who is now living in their basement. But the story is really about the father and how he deals with this. And the title, American Dream, has a number of meanings, I think. Wilson, I know you liked this story particularly as the editor of the review.
I liked it very much, and I think this particular issue of the Delmarva Review opens with a series of poems by an Argentinian American poet. And the and then progresses. This is the first short story, which also has to do with an Hispanic baseball player and the relationship with the father and the love interest, of course, with his daughter. But between when you start following the review all the way through, you see gradually that it's all about individuality. What makes me a human being, and what constitutes me as a person? And these are the stories that create the crises or the things to be celebrated in humans that make us who we are. And that's really what's behind American Dream.
Well, at the reading at the Writers' Center, there was a piece of flash fiction that was read. And I'd like for us to listen to that, if you would. And then, Wilson, say something about this piece of flash fiction written and read by Caroline Bock, The Secret Life of Pool Cleaners.
The Secret Life of Pool Cleaners. My job was to clean the swimming pool after the cops fished out Mr. Gatsby. Extra work, no extra pay. I scooped his fancy watch off the bottom and plucked it in my pocket. No one thinks of the unseen characters in fiction, the ones like me, who are yet to be written, or never get written, or get cut from the story in one of those drafts you hear writers grouse about. Listen up. I exist in the subconscious of the writer who never stopped writing that book you take for granted. I gotta believe that the story never truly ends. It only stops out of exhaustion or relief, or a deadline and threat from an editor. I keep cleaning the pool because some of us have real jobs. Look at here, the pool is ready to swim in again. The water clear and the sky blue, as far as I can see out to the Long Island Sound. The white plum tree quivers in full bloom. I'll have to skim out the debris of petals in the next day or so. Now the air is honey thick, and even I can appreciate the beauty of the scene. Fact is, after you fall asleep with the novel lost in your sheets, I might stake my claim. I might be what you dream about, me, a nobody. Remember me the next time you swim in a rich man's pool. Truth is, I might inspire you. Take that and mark your novel with it.
Wilson?
It's a wonderful piece of fun and not so much fun. It strikes your chord. It reaches a lot of different emotions, and yet it's fun to listen to. At the end, of course, it's a direct plea to writers, and so writers can appreciate it even more. But it's a fine example. Carolyn Bach has written a lot of flash fiction, and this is an example of flash fiction. Highly condensed, has tone, it has voice, and it has a plot that takes you from one feeling to another, and it's multi-level. It's wonderful.
It is wonderful, as is all of the fiction that is in this issue as well. And I'd like to mention just one other because of its difference on Wilson, and that is a kind of longish short story entitled Einstein. What is Einstein about, Wilson? Tell us just a little bit about this story.
Einstein is the longest short story that we have in this piece, and it's a delightful progression, if you will, a story that keeps unwinding and it keeps telling itself, and you'll find as you read it, you'll find that you just want to keep reading it. It's not taking you to one conclusion or to another. It is good versus evil. It is the impact of religion versus non-religion. It is black versus white. It has a lot of wonderful metaphors going through it. And I think that anyone who reads it's going to enjoy it at some level.
Well, I think that I was particularly struck by Einstein because you can read it on a number of different levels. For the scientific-minded, it works on with his writings actually from Einstein that he sprinkles through this story, and the sense that. The sense that the author, in a very good way, is playing with our minds, because it seems almost like to me a stream of consciousness that moves through times. He talks about the Amish girls, for instance, and calls them time travelers. Clop, 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 and they are traveling back in time to live in another era and period. And in that sense, he's playing with our minds again, and I think a very creative and a very enjoyable way. So I highly recommend Einstein for our listeners when they read their copy of the Delmarva review. Well, Anne and Wilson, thank you both for a wonderful edition of the Delmarva review, and thank you also for being on Delmarva Today Writers Edition. And just one more question
For you, Wilson, where can people get this issue of the Delmarva Review?
I'm glad you asked. Anyone can get it from Amazon.com. You can have it in your hands within a couple of days. You can get it in print edition or in electronic edition for your phones or tablets or however you may like to read it. We still like the print edition the best. And I might say that those who are interested in submitting work, writers out there who are listening, should check out our website, which is delmarvareview.org. And that's where you actually can read our guidelines and learn a lot more about our authors and about submitting. We are particularly pleased, I might add, to receive a grant from the Talbot County Arts Council and the Maryland State Arts Council, which helps along with private contributions so that we can do this.
Well, we mentioned that the Delmarva Review is a 501c3 corporation as well. So any participation in the review is tax deductible for our readers and our listeners. And now for our dramatic reading of Prairie Fever by Emily Ray Roberts, that is published in this volume 11 of the Delmarva Review. We're fortunate to have the author of Prairie Fever, Emily Roberts, with us also today. Emily, welcome to Delmarva Today Writer's Edition.
Thank you for having me.
Listen, Emily, let me say first of all that I think your story is an exceptional story. It's very moving, and I thought structurally, actually, quite sound and quite good. Prairie Fever. Where did you get the idea for Prairie Fever?
Well, I actually have done a lot of research. I'm very interested in American history, especially like frontier history. So I was always kind of drawn to this location, sort of the American West. And that combined with the idea of prairie fever, which is this sort of phenomenon that happens. So I kind of love to blend together sort of the history, but in a way that wasn't historical fiction necessarily.
Well, Emily, what is Prairie Fever? I know we get a good sense of it from your story, but tell us just a little bit about Prairie Fever itself.
So Prairie Fever is really just another name for depression. So when these people moved out sort of from the American East, where it was heavily forested and they were close to friends and family, to the prairies that were empty and you would live alone without really seeing anybody, they developed depression, but they didn't really have a word for it yet. So prairie fever really is just this sort of isolated word for depression.
Well, Emily, you're a student at Ohio State, and your story is set in Kansas. You have an excellent grasp of the wind and the vast emptiness of the Kansas plains. Have you lived in Kansas?
I'm very flattered that you think I have, but unfortunately, I haven't. But I've traveled through Kansas. And I've kind of seen like how flat it is. And I've been to other like plain states, Minnesota, North Dakota. And I read actually a lot of diaries of people who've lived in Kansas. And that kind of gave me this sense of the emptiness and the way that you can stand and see nothing for miles.
What is your interest in mental illness? And depression, we're taking depression here and prairie fever as a kind of mental illness.
My interest comes with my own experience with mental illness as someone who's experienced both anxiety and depression, and sort of the idea that in fiction, to present it in a way that's not necessarily extremely sad or extremely scary, as it is oftentimes portrayed, but as like a lens that shifts people's perspectives of the world around them. So I like the idea that it can change sort of the dynamics of an entire existence, but not necessarily in a way that is extremely shocking or something that can be understated even.
Emily, Myra in your story is a graduate student, and I understand that you're an undergraduate student at Ohio State University. Are you going to go on to graduate school, and do you see a career in writing?
Yes, I am very much interested in pursuing my MFA. Right now, I'm teetering sort of between whether my joy of writing lies in fiction or creative nonfiction, but I definitely want to pursue writing and I want to pursue getting my MFA.
Well, your story is excellent, and I want to thank you for being on with us today. And now let's listen to this dramatic reading of Prairie Fever by Emily Ray Roberts. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you.
Mira had no choice but to be caught up in the moment of silence, sitting on the half-crumpled sheets in apartment 5D, neck craning uncomfortably to stare at the slow rotation of the off-white fan above her. The room, lit only by the late morning sunlight, shrank down to the steady circling of the blades. She had never noticed it before, a symptom of faulty wiring. There came a sound like crashing from the other side of her bedroom wall, followed by the telltale snarling and snapping of her neighbors. They were wolves, she imagined, or stray and mangy dogs fighting over a scrap in a back alley, harsh barks and low growls muffled only by the thin layer of plaster between them. Her alarm began to beep, and she pulled herself to the edge of the mattress. Step one, turn it off. The beeping ceased, but the wolves still scratched at the wall. Stupid bitch! Step two, get dressed. Mira stood before fumbling along the clutter of the floor to find a clean enough pair of pants, a bra forgotten, a shirt that didn't smell. She put them on methodically, treasonous eyes straying back to the ceiling fan. Her living room had been overtaken by her research. Piles of books cluttered the floor, topped haphazardly with primary sources she'd scanned and printed for 4 cents a page. Copies of photographs of people with the smiles bleached from their faces by the unforgiving western sun stared at her from where she had taped them to the wall. This morning, she remembered to brush her teeth, and she did it with the toothbrush hanging limply from her mouth, too busy scanning the diary of a doctor living in the 1840s, describing in detail the medical maladies of the time. Snake bites, dysentery, and the worst of the lot, prairie fever. At least snakes had the common decency to kill the victim quickly. But prairie fever relied on the perceived fragility of the mind, striking those on their homesteads all alone, miles away from the nearest neighbor. It ate away at the hope for the future that drove them to the West. Prairie fever infected the very essence of yourself that spurred you to keep moving, living, and dreaming until it all rotted away. Kansas was a breeding ground for the fever. How could it not be? It's a wasteland where, in a good year, you eke out enough living to afford to clothe your family in something besides old flour sacks. It's a place where, in the bad years, the fires tear through the dry grass. Your sod house floods with half a foot of stagnant water. Locusts descend to eat every growing life. You could try to cover your cabbages with cloth, but they'll eat that too. A sudden blizzard rolls in to cull your herd of cattle. No wonder people went crazy. Bad years outnumbered the good. Her phone chirped again. Mira placed the book upside down on the porcelain edge and leaned over to spit in the sink, watching with slight satisfaction as the splotch crawled toward the drain. 5 minutes later, with her JanSport backpack slung over her shoulder, she wheeled her old, worn bicycle to the waiting elevator. When her mother and father had presented the obnoxiously pink, floral bicycle on her 13th birthday, she had been thrilled. In the meantime, after years of riding through the suburbs' paved cul-de-sacs and the occasional crash into innocent bushes, the paint had begun to chip and the front T attached to the handlebars was permanently bent to the right, a quirk that caused her to gently veer toward the nearest brick wall. But because she loved the stupid thing, and she couldn't afford a new backpack, much less a car, Mira dutifully climbed aboard and cycled to one of two destinations, school or Beijing Palace, the only good Chinese place within 2 miles that refused to deliver. Today she turned north toward campus while her mind wandered to western trails of 1842. On the surface, the streets were desolate, except for the indifferent tumbling of litter, moving steadily along with the wind, like Mira, as if having an appointment to get to and no time for the others around them. But beneath the surface of calm, the city was alive, thriving as the prairie does, with life hidden beneath the careful shelter of the waving grasses and blooming flowers. Instead of prairie dogs and beetles, rats skittered in the shelter of alleyways, and cockroaches traced hidden highways in the towering brick buildings, driven into apartment walls by the dropping temperatures. But much like the prairie, life was a tender thing, burning out as readily as it had sprung up blazing. Without warning, two hissing, screeching tomcats tumbled out of a nearby alleyway, all puffed fur and bared fangs. Instinctively, Mira jerked her handlebars. By pure luck, she managed to avoid the pair. Skirting around the two, she turned her head to appraise the showdown happening at 11:42 a.m. It looked like the ginger was winning, but the black was scarred and scrappy. She wondered idly as she rounded the next corner if she would ever see the loser again. Probably not. Such was the way of life, after all. It still felt wrong to pass room 106, standing like a ghost town with its darkened windows and bolted door. Mira knew if she was to press her forehead against the cool glass, she would see the familiar room and that old oak desk with most of its knickknacks standing guard as they gathered dust. Her current advisor's office was nothing like it, cold and clinical with its burnished silver accents and the bookcases that stared down at Mira. She pulled herself away from the office, continuing her journey, which grew more tiring step after step as she dragged herself up the stairs that seemed like mountains. Dr. Himshaw was waiting, all crisp shirt and heavy brows, staring up at her as she hesitantly knocked on the doorframe. "Come in, Ms. Reed." Dr. Stanton never called her that. She would have stood up from her cluttered workspace, face brightening as she dragged out, "Mira!" like it was taffy, and offered her a cup of tea and her choice of chocolate from the George Washington bowl. "Why don't you pick George's brain, Mira?" Himshaw could bludgeon her with the way he said "Reed." Mira sat down cautiously, swinging her backpack around and brandishing it like a torn fabric shield on her lap. He looked at her and she saw smoke on the horizon, the dangerous wisps that spoke of coming ruination. She could already feel the panic rising up in her throat. Her fingers itched to gather up the water-soaked flour sacks and beat it back, those flames that threatened everything she lived for. Instead, her hand reached back to stroke her auburn hair, and Mira realized, belatedly, that she had forgotten to brush her hair this morning when she found a matted hunk near the back. Have you decided your argument? He asked. The movement of his folding hands caught her attention. No, I'm still reading, but I think I'm going to rely on prairie fever as a frontier epidemic. I'm thinking about how it's not just the physical environment that makes people lose it. This was not true. She had decided her argument, but that was back with Stanton, who nodded her head energetically whenever Mira had let slide that she was considering prairie fever as the subject of her thesis. A gentle prod to the right path might accompany it, but Stanton had always listened in a way that made Mira's words feel worth something. What do you mean? When you boil down the instances of prairie fever, it's just psychotic breaks. But people have meltdowns in the modern era, in cities and suburbs and in clinical doctors' offices. Depression can happen anywhere for any reason. It can't be just the emptiness. It has to be something more, a human factor that the prairie taps into, some phenomena that can be explained using the prairie. Yes, Dr. Hemshaw nods, but Ms. Reed, this is history. It's not the social sciences or psychology. We don't answer these questions. I understand your previous advisor encouraged you to go beyond the span of our field, but if you want to have a successful thesis review, you need to focus more on the time, on the primary sources. Do they support this? Not yet. Well, the graying man said, thin lips disappearing into the set line of his mouth. Then you don't really have an argument at all. I'm going to send a couple of essays to you. Maybe seeing what other historians are arguing could help you finalize your thesis. But as a reminder, your deadline is in 2 weeks. After that, we will need to begin serious prepping for your review in May. You're already very behind. She could see the flames now, in her mind, eating their way through the dry grasses toward the work she had carefully cultivated since she had graduated from undergrad 2 years back. Yeah. Mira had missed 6 calls from her mother. Had it really been just 4 days since they'd spoken? Her thumb hovered hesitantly over the green phone icon as she slowed her descent down the ornate front stairs of the history department. She tucked it to her side before venturing down toward the place where she had chained her bike to a street lamp. What was there even to talk about? Hello, yes, I didn't kill a cat, so I think I had a good day. Or maybe she was having a bad day. It was hard to tell. But there was only a wheel chained to the post. Mira glanced up and down the street. No bicycle. She didn't want to talk to her mother, but her voice still played in her ears. Mira, you need to quit it with this thing. There's a whole lot of history. Gotta be something less depressing. But it wasn't just something, was it? No, like she had whined harshly 5 days ago. It was everything. She kicked the wheel out of spite. Who even takes a bicycle with only one wheel? It isn't even a bicycle at that point. Sighing, Mira bent to unchain the lonely wheel and instead looped it through the handle at the top of her backpack, leaving it to dangle there and anchor her more firmly to the ground with its insistent weight. It deserved a proper burial, that only piece left. The temperature dropped steadily, the January skies harboring thick, gray clouds that threatened and menaced the people below. They were the kind of gray that warned you to buy milk and bread and peanut butter at the store, just in case. Mira was reminded of a story she had read years ago as she drudged in the direction of home. Maybe it had started all of this, maybe not. Like many of the things she read these days, it took place on the Kansas prairie. A young woman heard every night for weeks the howling of encircling wolves, driven by hunger to the promise of her little sod house. Her husband was gone somewhere. She was alone. And one night, when she heard the wolves through the dirt walls, she left the gun on the table, flung open the doors, and walked out into the void of the dark flatlands where the beasts tore her into pieces. Another casualty of the fever. Mira clenched her phone harder in her fist. How were they all so easily infected? Who would throw themselves to the mercy of hungry wolves? but in a way she understood. And that understanding hit her with the force of a bullet. It left her floundering, tumbling until her mind was pinned to the ground by some stronger beast. A wolf, or maybe a feral cat. Mira stopped in the center of the sidewalk, watching the people part around her seamlessly. Her cell phone threatened to fall to its death as her fingers went limp, but she couldn't bring herself to care. The others stretched all around her, heads bobbing in an undulating wave of movement. There was no beginning, no end, just the endless stretch as far as she could see in front of her. She was choked by it. This was her frontier, a barren prairie of concrete and glass. The snow began falling, thick and heavy, dampening the sounds of the people and Mira's slow footsteps as she lumbered, dazed and sluggish, toward home. Mira took the stairs. The burn of her thighs and back and the slapping of the one loose bicycle tire felt good. There was the number 5, bold and shiny in cheap, chipped copper plating. Pushing open the door, she entered her hallway, walking slowly and leaving in occasional intervals a drop of white from the snow. It had begun to melt when she started her ascent, and it soaked into what it could and sloughed off what it couldn't. Mindlessly, she trudged past A, past B, but stilled when she heard the wolves growling and snapping in apartment C. She hardly registered her own raised hand, poised to knock. Dare she? No, no, not now. Not with the cold wetness soaking into her bones. There was 5D waiting for her, and when she opened the door, she was greeted by the symptoms of her own fever. Papers strewn across every available surface, black and white photos and her own scribbled notes taped to the wall. Mira began to shake, the cold replaced with something warmer, a fire in her stomach. Her backpack slid to the floor, the metallic clang ringing empty in her ears. Her movements were staccato. The winds howled. Somewhere a black tomcat shivered in the snow, scarred and bleeding, but alive. The woman walked to the window, fiddling with the latch and tugging, straining, lifting until it opened with a pop and a gust of wind and cold surged into the space. Papers fluttered on the walls, slid off of coffee tables, and scattered across the floor. Trembling hands gathered the nearest pile and with a cry flung them out. They floated, listless and lifeless on the winter wind, blending with the white so that it was all she could see out there. Nothing. Not a building, not a person, not a tree or a bird or a cat. Just the white. It was blinding, but the blindness brought no calm. Her fingers ached with cold from where she gripped the sill. She yanked the window down, body shaking from more than the damp. And when she left her apartment, wandered back outside to the streets, the fever still burned hot in her stomach and pricked at her eyes. It took her an hour to salvage what she could.
A great thanks to Madeline Slater for this wonderful reading of Prairie Fever. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.